This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, May 20th. I'm Carla Blumenkrantz, news director of NewYorker.com, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. During the past 11 days, there has been a dramatic surge in violence in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Hamas has fired rockets on Israel, Israel has bombarded Gaza, and Israelis and Palestinians have waged war in the streets. Around 230 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, including at least 64 children. At least 21 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. In Israel, 12 have died. While activists rally support for the Israeli and the Palestinian causes, and international pressure mounts, talks are underway for a ceasefire. But on Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is politically imperiled inside the country, struck an aggressive tone when talking about Hamas.
There are only two ways that you can deal with them. You can either conquer them, and that's always an open possibility, or you can deter them. And we are engaged right now in forceful deterrence, but I have to say, we don't rule out anything. We hope we can restore quiet. We hope we can restore it quickly. I want to say that we're doing that while doing our utmost to avoid civilian casualties. I want to make that a little...
Ruth Margalit, a contributor to The New Yorker based in Tel Aviv, joins me to discuss this deadly escalation and what it means for the future of both Israel and Palestine. Ruth, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks, Carla.
So could you remind us what precipitated this most recent surge in violence, what some have called a renewed war?
Sure. So I would say there was relative calm in Israel until about earlier this month, when what was believed to be the imminent expulsion of six Palestinian families from their homes in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah led Palestinians in East Jerusalem to take to the streets. And around the same time, the New York Times has reported the microphones at the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem were broken off by Israeli police at the start of Ramadan because of a speech that the Israeli president was giving at the time. And so there was this sort of amalgamation of factors, and also these TikTok videos that surfaced of Palestinians, sort of random acts of violence that then led to a far-right group in Jerusalem to march through the streets. And all of these factors led to mass protests in Jerusalem that included the throwing of rocks, Molotov cocktails, and then the storming of police into Al-Aqsa Mosque into the compound itself, using tear gas and stun grenades. And then Hamas responds to this provocation in Al-Aqsa by firing rockets into Jerusalem. And Israel responds with airstrikes on Gaza. And so we're now on day 11 of this, of the escalation. I will just add, though, that is the most recent backdrop to the story. But you also have to take into consideration the fact that, you know, for the past 12 years, Israel has had a right-wing government that really benefited from kind of weakening the Palestinian Authority so that Israel really wouldn't have to enter peace negotiations with them. And the status quo sort of, you know, it benefited Israel.
I wonder if you can talk then about Netanyahu's role in all of this. As you said, he's been in power for the past 12 years. He represents a very conservative constituency in the country, which is quite divided, not unlike the United States. And he's also been in a fair amount of trouble recently. He faced his fourth election in 2 years, and it seemed very likely that he would not be able to form a coalition until very recently. He's also been on trial for 3 corruption-related charges. Could you talk about Netanyahu's situation going into this conflict and how it may have changed because of the violence?
Netanyahu was in many respects finished politically when this round of escalation began. You know, he had had his 28 days to form a government and he was unsuccessful. And it looked like for the first time in 12 years, there was really a chance for some of the other parties, a kind of weird mix of centrist parties and leftist parties and right-wing parties to form a coalition without him and oust him. And really the one thing that kind of united this strange coalition was a real kind of anti-BB stance, anti-Netanyahu stance. And all this, as you said, while Netanyahu is also standing trial for corruption charges. So the reality is that, you know, Israel was on the brink of having a new government, and now it isn't. The part of the this what's known as the change coalition in Israel, these parties that, you know, that were trying to form an alternative government, Naftali Bennett, who heads a very right-wing party, he stopped and kind of dropped out of these talks to form an alternative government because this new government would rely on the support of an Arab party. And he has decided that he can't enter a government that relies on the support of an Arab party in light of all the of the recent escalation in Gaza.
So you currently live in Tel Aviv. You grew up in Jerusalem. And I wonder, what is it like for you on the ground right now? What feels the same or different from past conflicts?
I would say two things are different about this round of conflict. First, I think the scale is just momentous, you know, especially the devastation in Gaza, but also the sheer number and the reach of Hamas rockets. And I guess the second thing is that now, for the first time, there's also a real sense there's a movement and a sense of solidarity and mobilization across the Palestinian community, both in Gaza, in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, and now also within Israel proper. And until now, that was rarely the case. You know, even as Israel had these rounds of conflict with Hamas, the Arab population living inside Israel wasn't as vocal in its opposition to what was going on as it is now. And, you know, for the Israeli security establishment, that's a worrying development. But also within the mixed cities, and I went out reporting in some of those mixed Jewish Arab cities, you know, the message I got was that it was really just a matter of time. I asked one Arab resident in one of those mixed cities that I'm sure we'll talk about. I asked him, you know, were you surprised by the violence that is going on within Israel now? I asked him, are you surprised? And he said, no, I knew this was coming and I'm still shocked that it happened. And I guess I sort of feel the same, or there was a sense that kind of the writing is on the wall, you know, with the policy of this government for the past 12 years, but also, but it's also still shocking that it's happening.
So you visited Lod in your reporting, where about 72% of the population is Jewish and 27% is Arab. And in the past, this was a city that was really known for its coexistence. That's completely changed in the past week or two. I wonder if you can tell us about its history, and then perhaps we can talk about what you saw in your visit.
Sure. Well, first, you know, while Israeli cities tend to be pretty homogeneous in composition, you know, Jewish and some, you know, in some cases, Arab villages or Arab cities, there are seven so-called mixed cities where there is a sizable Arab population living alongside a majority Jewish population. And Lod is one of those cities. It's close to Tel Aviv. It's close to the airport. It's very poor. And for decades now, it's had soaring crime rates, drug-related violence, illegal weapons, just, you know, mounting problems. Even at, you know, at the same time, its Jewish and Arab populations have managed to live in relative peace with each other. But, you know, not to say that things were ideal, far from it, particularly within the local Arab community. There was this added problem of not being able to buy land and property and expand homes. So what happened was that as these protests broke out in East Jerusalem over Sheikh Jarrah and the raiding of Al-Aqsa, they also erupted in Lod. And the police responded with force there. And then really kind of since then, in the subsequent riots, a local Arab man was shot and killed, apparently by Jewish rioters. A day later, a Jewish man is dragged out of his car and beaten to death. And this sort of extreme violence has recurred there really every single night for the past week. And add to that the fact that you have a mayor who's seen as very close to Netanyahu and the ruling Likud party. And he declares a nighttime curfew on the city, you know, as these riots are happening. And still some groups of Jewish settlers come from outside the city. And they sort of patrol the streets, you know, carrying firearms at night, despite the curfew. So the flames of this fire just kept kind of growing and growing. And you kind of, you see the results of this all around the city. You know, I was there this week and you still see the torched cars everywhere and shattered glass and burned buildings. And then when you talk to people, you realize that it's a real rupture. I spoke to one community organizer, I also mentioned in my piece, and his whole mission is to kind of forge these bonds between Jews and Arabs in the city and get them to work together and form these associations of, you know, tenant associations, because they also share homes, share buildings. And he said that he said, I don't know how I can carry on, you know, that it's just, it seems like a real turning point in the city now.
I wonder if we can talk more about what has changed that has brought so many people to the streets, that has made the conflict so much more personal and violent on the ground between individuals. One thing that we've noticed abroad is that social media seems to be playing a big role in disseminating information, particularly about the deadly Israeli assaults on Gaza and the Palestinian perspective of the Israeli occupation. What role do you think social media, as well as conventional media, has played in activating individuals and in circulating information about what's happening on the ground?
I think it's played a substantial role, you know, both in the sense that some of the initial tensions began because of these sort of sporadic TikTok videos that some Palestinian users uploaded that then led to a march of a kind of Jewish supremacist group in the city, but also in the unfiltered videos that we see now of the, you know, of what's going on in Gaza. I think that had a real effect sort of worldwide on television within Israel. That gets less airtime. You know, the devastation in Gaza, we don't see it as much on Israeli TV networks. But again, because of social media, it's still, you know, people still see it, you know, on Twitter and other, you know, other websites. And so that also has to do with the real breakdown of the role of the military censor in Israel. And that's an institution that has been very present, you know, until recently, you know, in wars and in conflict, in kind of deciding what stories get told within Israel. And now with social media, I think the censor kind of lost control over what gets aired, what doesn't. So there's a kind of a breakdown of that.
What is the sentiment among the Israelis you know and speak to about what's happening now? Has the added information, has the sort of change in the conflict itself affected how people speak and feel about this?
It sort of depends who you talk to. Within Israel, there's still a real support for this, for the continued airstrikes, even as the whole world is calling for a ceasefire. Within Israel, that's still not the case. But among liberal voices in Israel, there's a sense that, you know, that this is really an escalation that is just untenable. And there is a sense that, you know, that Hamas bears responsibility for starting with the rocket fire. And so I think initially there was support for some form of airstrikes or some form of, you know, of hitting Hamas targets. But I think the more this is carrying on, the less this can be justified. And I think among liberal Israelis, certainly there's an understanding of that. And so you start seeing these kind of local protests of, you know, both Arabs and Jews calling, you know, both in solidarity, but also calling on the government to stop and to reach some sort of agreement, or, you know, reach some sort of settlement where this whole, you know, where this escalation can cease.
In the U.S., Democrats are involved in an internal battle about the Biden administration's position toward Israel. Progressives such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, and Cori Bush have shown their support for Palestinians on the House floor. Ocasio-Tlaib and Mark Pocan have also drafted a resolution that would block a proposed bomb sale to Israel. Meanwhile, Biden has continually stressed his administration's support for the country. How do you see this conflict in the U.S. and perhaps some shift in the Democrats' posture affecting sentiments and even policy in Israel?
This is reported widely in Israel, the fact that there is this shift in Israel and these rising kind of more left, I would say, voices within the Democratic Party. And you hear reports about this, and you know, I guess the kind of the government's response is to worry about that and to say, you know, this isn't playing out well kind of worldwide. But you asked earlier, you know, what's changed in this round of escalation. So I think one crucial thing is this, is exactly this, is ebbing of support within the United States. And that's both, you know, the rise of these voices calling on President Biden to be more forceful in his approach to Netanyahu and in calling for a ceasefire. But it also has to do with the fact that, you know, within Israel, there has been this government that's extremely right-wing, more so than in any point in history. And we're seeing the cost of that now internationally.
What's likely to happen next then with Netanyahu?
So now there are these voices calling on Israel for a ceasefire, and it looks as though President Biden is pushing for that. I see even as we heard at the beginning, we heard this clip by Netanyahu being very belligerent in his approach. There are these breaking news reports that we are likely to see a ceasefire declared perhaps sometime today or tomorrow. That this actually might be sort of unilaterally declared by Israel. And the point being that Netanyahu is hoping that perhaps by declaring it unilaterally, if then Hamas continues to strike, then Israel can respond with airstrikes and sort of gets, I guess, you know, a kind of green light, because, you know, because that would seem as a provocation.
We've seen this sort of back and forth involving bombing and ceasefires and rockets. And inevitably that element of the conflict usually comes to some sort of close for some period of time. But what do you make of this other element, the conflict that we're seeing in the streets, the individuals who are engaging in violence against each other, oftentimes neighbors? What do you think that means for Israel and the occupied territories? And where does this conflict go next, perhaps?
You know, I think that's one of the most worrying aspects of this escalation. I mean, obviously, there's the devastation in Gaza. There is, you know, Israeli citizens running to bomb shelters almost daily. And so as a routine, you know, it's just untenable, but there's a sense that, you know, normalcy at some point, some kind of normalcy will return until the next round of escalation. But this new development within Israel of the kind of breakdown of Jewish-Arab relations and the rising violence within these mixed cities, that's really worrying, because, you know, part of this country was built on this notion that you know, Jews and Arabs can live side by side. And, you know, some say that this notion of coexistence, I heard some Arab residents in Lod saying that, you know, oh, it's only Jews talk about coexistence. You know, Arabs in Israel would never use that word because they don't feel that they have, you know, equal rights, that it isn't a coexistence. But still, at the same time, there was, you know, a sense of kind of neighborly relations and relative calm. And if that continues to be broken, and if violence continues to soar, it's just worrying for the future of Israel.
Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you, Carla.
It's good to talk to you, and I hope that you and your family stay safe. Ruth Margalit is a journalist based in Tel Aviv. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app, and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Carla Blumenkrantz, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.